This is Terry Crosby.
Andy Steiger.
Steve Kim.
Welcome to the AC Podcast. On this podcast, we want to help you understand and speak the language of our culture and address questions being asked with intellectual honesty, gentleness, and respect. Good day, guys. How you doing?
Man, it's good to be with you, Terry. If you haven't noticed, I have my Barry Manilow voice on today.
When did that start?
It started a couple days ago. I started not feeling so good. All of a sudden, cold season is upon us, apparently.
Already?
I know, but you know what? The truth be told, I am pleased with my body in many ways. But if there is one
Tell us, please.
Yeah, I'm going to leave it at that. But if there's one thing that does not please me about this flesh and blood I've been given is its susceptibility to the common cold, Terry. I think that's one of those things I might need to bring up with the Lord one day.
Yeah, I probably should have sat in the other room. I don't want to catch nothing from you.
Well, when I cough, I project it away.
You know, when you see the Lord, you should probably ask him, too, about your thumb.
Yeah, that was the other one. Did you have some extra parts or something? Didn't know what to do with them? Hey, angels, just put them in the thumbs. Yo, Terry, you're laughing a little too hard at that.
I think we should put pictures on her, right? Of your thumbs.
My hands, good grief, my hands are huge. Mitts with sausages.
Oh, man. Plucked on them. That's good. That's good. Start the morning.
Anyway, it's like I got big toes on my hands. Come on.
All right. I got an article. And this is going to address your new series that you're bringing up in Young Adults, Modern Romance.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So this guy, and this is very recent, within the last week, from the University of Calgary. This is the title, Nicole from Last Night, University of Calgary student, mass emails 247 Nicoles.
Okay, so let me just get this straight. Some student decided he's going to mass email 200.
He meets a girl.
Some odd Nicoles. Oh.
He meets a girl.
He's looking for Cinderella.
Yeah, and he takes her and her friend home. The girl gives him a number, but it's not the right number. And he didn't get her last name.
You got to start asking yourself some serious questions at this point.
That's what. Okay, this is the email he sent, and he sent it to 247 Nicoles at University of Calgary.
Okay, because this guy's thinking she accidentally didn't give me her last name and messed up on her digits. I need to find this special someone.
Yeah. Ever the optimist.
Yeah, that's right. Met you last night, and you gave me the wrong number. Hi, this is a mass email to all the Nicoles. If you don't fit the description, then ignore it. And if you are the one who just don't want to talk to me, that's okay as well. If your name is Nicole and you're from Holland and you think Nietzsche is depressing, then text me. Boy, this guy.
Wow.
I'm Carlos, by the way. I'm the guy who took you and your friend home last night. So he's on the hunt to find this Nicole.
That girl that finds Nietzsche depressing.
That's right.
I know. He's going to get like 100 Nicoles texting back.
But there's a couple positives from this thing. First of all, the Nicoles at the U of C thought this was quite funny and hilarious. So it went viral really fast on social media. And then they created a Nicole from Last Night Facebook.
Of course they did.
And they eventually, you know, all met up and they started meeting together and finding other Nicoles within University of Calgary. So he continues his quest. This girl that he met does not have a U of C email at all. So she gets the message from all these other Nicoles. And she's just a visiting student from Holland.
So he finds her.
He finds her. Another positive thing with all
But
this.
Does she want to be found? That's the question, Terry.
Well, in the end, she says it was an honest mistake.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, she says, you know, I gave her the wrong number, but everything's good. We can go out.
Wow, quite a story from there.
No kidding. Mm. And this guy had, you know.
It takes some courage, man.
It takes some.
And a lot of work. How do you find all those Nicoles on your campus? I don't know. but it's impressive.
Very good. He got his reward in the end.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? It's a neighborly day in this beauty wood, a neighborly day for a beauty. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? I have always wanted to have a neighbor just like you. I've always wanted to live in a neighborhood with you, so let's make the most of this beautiful day. Since we're together, we might as well say, would you be mine? Could you be mine? Won't you be my neighbor? Won't you please? Won't you please? Please, won't you be my neighbor?
So today we're going to talk about a documentary that came out in the last couple months. Won't You Be My Neighbor? And it is a documentary of Fred Rogers.
I've been seeing it on iTunes, and to be honest with you, Terry, I've avoided it.
I know. But I mean, did you guys watch it when you were growing up? Did you?
Oh, of course I did.
You did?
Oh, absolutely. I watched Mr. Rogers. Oh, yeah. I remember that song. I remember him coming in, putting on that sweater. Remember watching him tie his shoes. And I always remember thinking to myself, this is one weird dude. But at the same time, I always remember thinking, he's probably one of the nicest human beings on the planet. And I always remember as a kid thinking, is he actually that nice?
Yeah.
That was always a question in the back of my mind. And it's funny because in the documentary, that comes up a couple times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is he that nice?
Yeah. Is he legit?
Well, I avoided it. Like, I didn't find it very interesting. I kind of this is a little weird.
No, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it.
I think it was a set and the stuff like that. But that really kind of, it was just minimal stuff, right?
Now, you have to understand, though. Now, I don't know what TV watching was like for you guys. But for me, in my house, we did not have cable. So my options were pretty limited, Terry. It was bunny ears, man. I was moving around the bunny ears.
Yeah.
Millennials have no idea what I'm talking about right now. You know? Oh, yeah. And there were times where I had to sit there and I had to touch those antennas the whole time to get a proper reception to watch a show.
Try to raise it as far up as you can, right?
To get the
signal.
So there wasn't a lot of options. So public television was often all I had. So that's one of the reasons I watched it. I mean, I watched episodes of Perry Mason, man, in black and white. Because that's all there was.
Are you lying about your age? Like, it sounds like...
I know.
It sounds like you go way back.
I know. You would think so. Old soul, young body, Terry.
Yeah. So this documentary was directed by Morgan Neville. And a trailer for the documentary debuted on Rogers' 90th birthday, March 12, 2018. Released in the United States in June 8th, 2018. It has become the highest grossing biographical documentary of all time.
That's hard to believe.
Yeah. So last I thought I saw was over 25 million. That's still not a lot in respect to movies and stuff like that, but it is the highest biographical documentary right now.
Wow. I'm amazed.
Yeah, that is pretty amazing, especially given, I mean, the article, the review that we're going to talk about brings it up too, but this documentary doesn't have all of the stuff that would make it a successful documentary. Cause in a sense, this documentary is so, uninteresting in a sense.
Yeah.
Because Fred Rogers just seems to be this very flat kind of a person. Maybe flat isn't the right word, but
I watched it last night with my kids, actually, and I was surprised. They stayed with me and watched the whole thing.
Wow. Okay.
And they found it pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old.
Yeah. Mm. So it was first aired in the United States in 1963. And then finally concluded. It was revamped a number of times in this
period. You're talking about the show.
The show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and continued until August 31st, 2001.
Well, hey, I'll just jump in here. One of the things that I was surprised by, now I've seen the show as a kid, and I recognized all of the characters that they talked about. But one of the things that I didn't realize about the show was how cutting edge it was. And in one sense, the show was incredibly not cutting edge because of, you know, its amateur puppeteering and, you know, and just its basic, you know, storylines and the sets. You know, they were all very basic. However, one of the things that comes out in the documentary, which I think is very fascinating, is that the topics that Mr. Rogers was speaking on were timely. So they were issues that were going on in the culture. For example, they discuss not just the war, but he did a week-long series on death, for example, and talked about the astronaut, which I remember vividly, that teacher that was selected to be a part of the Challenger. And I remember watching on TV that exploding as a kid and thinking to myself, what just happened? And then realizing that this lady had died and, you know, and at school, everybody's trying to process through that. And here he is doing shows on those things, helping kids to work through the realities of life. And I think that there's something quite significant to say about that.
When I watched it, it was really interesting. Like I said earlier, he didn't seem like a very interesting character, you know, right from the get-go. He just seems like seemingly average guy with an average name doing his thing. And quite frankly, I didn't grow up with Fred Rogers because I grew up in Korea and Fred Rogers just wasn't a thing there. I always heard his name, though, right? I heard his name mentioned a number of times. I just wanted to find out more about this guy. And that as I started watching this documentary, I'm like, oh man, I couldn't put the documentary down. One thing that really stuck out to me was just how real he was in terms of, like, he didn't shy away from all of these difficult topics. He was so dedicated to educating children and entering into their world and just not leaving them abandoned. And I remember watching this going, wow, that's such a Christian response to children. I was just reading this article the other day. I was kind of revisiting it. There's this article from theweek.com called How Christianity Invented Children. And just the idea of the way we look at children, the way we cherish them in this culture is so much rooted in Christianity and our idea of this equal dignity among people, including children. It's so part of our culture that we don't even recognize where it's coming from.
Or we don't even recognize that it was lacking in the past.
Right. And now it seems to me the work is almost like kind of continued on in the person of Fred Rogers, because children were so, I guess, abandoned when it comes to public television and things like that. And here's Fred Rogers saying, you know what? Children's feelings are important. We need to teach them how to process these things. We need to integrate them into the life of the public by way of talking about things like the assassination of a political figure, talking about death, talking about the explosion of the Challenger. And I just found that really fascinating.
A lot of the ideas that he introduced within the show were kind of anti-cultural. You know what I mean? The fact that a lot of it was Christian ideas. I mean, one of the articles talks
about
it.
Are you thinking about the racism aspect of it, where he had, for example, a black police officer.
Right.
And would do specific episodes to counter exactly what was going on in culture at the
time. Right, to invite him to put his feet in the same pool on the show and wash their feet together was against the fact that some hotel managers were trying to get all the black people out of the pools at that particular point in time. But, I mean, he introduced a lot of things that even today people are talking about. Like, one article talked about the emotional intelligence he tried to bring into the shows. The mindfulness, that's a big piece today with a lot of people. And just slowing down TV, slowing down culture in a sense, that we have to take a moment and reflect on a lot of things.
That was one thing I always found interesting about the show as a kid, reflecting back, is that Mr. Rogers was not hurried in anything that he did. He took his time, which went against the mold. Most people would tell you, listen, in TV, you got to keep people's attention. You got to move as fast as you can. and be as interesting as possible, right? And
right.
He just did the exact opposite.
I don't think I have to have a hat to, you know, flip off or anything like that. I mean, in the movie itself, he says something and then he looks at you right into the camera and stops for a second. Like he's actually talking to you.
Yeah, one time in the documentary, they show that there was an episode where he just let kids see what a minute was. And he didn't do or say anything for a minute on the show. I mean, a minute on TV, I mean, that is an eternity.
Some dead air.
Yeah. It's just surprising to think how much courage it took just to do some of the things he did. Now, it's interesting. We look back on it and we're like, wow, that was innovative. But at the time, you know, I don't really think people realize how significant what he was doing was.
There's some really great lines from Fred Rogers himself in the documentary. There's one that goes, "Love is at the root of everything, all learning, all relationships, love or the lack of it. Won't you be my neighbor is an invitation for someone to be close to you. The greatest thing we can do is to help someone know that we are loved and capable of loving." And the director, he kind of sums up Fred's message. And he says, when I distill it, he talked about grace. It's this idea that kindness is not a naive notion, like believing in unicorns and rainbows or something. It's like oxygen. It is vital and needs to be nurtured.
Now, what's interesting about that is, you know, you could say one of Mr. Rogers' greatest traits, you know, his trademark loving, caring attitude and really uplifting children and referring to them as special, it ultimately becomes something that he's criticized for later. Many people saw him as really starting this generation of entitlement with this idea that you don't need to earn that respect. You know, you don't need to earn being special. It's just given to you that you're just important and special and that people should take note of you.
And they play a little clip from Fox News of a news anchor decries Rogers and the narcissistic society he gave birth to.
Do you guys think that's a fair critique?
When I was watching that, I mean, the effect from the documentary is obvious because you've seen Fred Rogers and what he is about up to that point. And this is right at the end of the documentary. And when you listen to that person, that anchor person, talk about how Fred Rogers created a generation of entitled narcissists, you are angry because you see how disconnected it is. Now, when I saw that, I noticed that this anchor person was missing the point, because what Fred Rogers was talking about was, and they show a clip of him actually explaining himself too, that basically that when I say you're special, I'm basically saying that you don't have to do anything substantial to be loved. So what he's talking about is love. What the anchor person was talking about was respect and accomplishment, right? Of course, if you want to earn respect, you have to do something special. But what Fred Rogers was talking about was you have dignity and you deserve to be loved just the way you are. Now, I find that some people will say, well, respect should be the default. And I thought the distinction that was made by Jordan Peterson one time was really helpful to me, because when we say, you know, respect should be the default attitude towards other people, what we really mean, I think, is decency. The default should be decency on the basis of the dignity that person has. Respect is something that goes above and beyond that decency. And I think, again, there was that disconnect. They're talking about two different things. Fred Rogers is talking about love. That anchor person was talking about respect.
See, that's always the philosopher that will come out in me when I hear Mr. Rogers say things like, "I love you just the way you are." Now, the philosopher in me wants to come out and say, "Yeah, but, you know, what if this kid is beating up on Tommy? You know, and he's just a bully and a terrible human being." But I think if you start going that route, you've missed what Mr. Rogers is saying. Mm. He's saying that you have inherent dignity as a human being and that you don't need to earn my love for you, that you deserve to be loved simply because you are a human being endowed with dignity. And in that, you can see, in the documentary gets at this, you can see Mr. Rogers' worldview at play here, that he saw the world from a Christian perspective, mm-hmm. that you have a creator that has endowed you with value, and for that reason, you are to be loved and cared for.
You are special no matter what, right? That's what his full focus was on the show itself. I mean, you don't have to be special to be loved. Like, mm-hmm. that's a big point within Christianity.
Yeah, and I think, you know, sometimes we want to go too far down the road and we want to think about some prisoner or something like that, or, you know, some inmate who's done something terrible. And then you run that whole, I love you just the way you are. And you start to go, I don't know if I do love that person just the way they are. And I think if you do that, you've gone two steps too far. You've missed the main point. With regards to a child, we're talking about them as a human being and loving them, understanding the dignity that they've been created with and for. Now this leads us, I think, into an interesting conversation with regards to Mr. Rogers' famous tagline, won't you be my neighbor, right? And this idea of what it looks like to be a good neighbor. And as I think about that, I think about the Bible, particularly Jesus, Luke chapter 10, where he's asked a similar question with regards to being a good neighbor. I'm reading out of Luke chapter 10, verse 25. There's an expert in the law who's been listening to Jesus. They're impressed by his teaching. And he says to him, "Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" So what do I need to know in this life to be a good Jew, to be a human being that receives a place in heaven? And Jesus asks him a question, says, "Well, what's written in the law? You know, how do you read it?" And the man replies, "Well, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." Now, this, by the way, is very Hebraic, and this teacher of the law is quoting from Deuteronomy chapter 6, the Shema, and this idea that, you know, love God with everything that it is to be a human being, your heart, your soul, your, you know, all your strength and your mind, everything. Love God. And now you know that this guy's been listening to Jesus because he adds on Leviticus 19 to this, and love your neighbor as yourself. And basically, Jesus comes at this point over and over again that if you love God, you will love people because God loves people. And God created people, right? He created them in his image, in his likeness. People have been created, endowed with dignity. You come stock with value into this world. You don't have to do anything to earn it. God gave it to you. And now this man, you know, Luke tells us that he wants to justify himself in deciding who his neighbor is. So he asks Jesus, you know, who is my neighbor? Now, in the Jewish culture in which he lived in, as you guys know, there were people that they wanted to love, like their own people, the Jews. But there were many people that they did not want to love. And one such person was the Samaritans. If you don't know about the Samaritans, the Jews referred to them as half-breeds. They were a group of Jews that were left after the Babylonian captivity. They intermarried and they took on, and I think this is a significant point, they took on different religious practices. They only accepted the first five books of the Old Testament. They saw Moses as the last prophet. They did not see Jerusalem, nor did they recognize the temple in Jerusalem, but instead their own temple and their own place of worship at Mount Gerizim. Now, this is all significant because, you know, this guy is asking this question because he wants to justify that there's some people he wants to love, but there are some people that he does not want to love. Mm-hmm.
This is his legalism coming out, right? This is a systematic thing for him. So I want to figure out who my neighbor is, who my neighbor isn't, so I can just love the people that I want to love and leave out the rest.
Right. So you're saying to some people, won't you be my neighbor? And to others, you're not my neighbor.
Right. And that's the very bubble that Jesus is bursting because he changes the focus from who is my neighbor to no, to whom are you being neighborly? It's not so much about who the people are around you. It's more about who you are inside, right? It's your inner disposition.
Now, this is a good point that Steve's bringing us to, and that is that Jesus is now going to change the direction of this conversation, and he's going to start to address this man's heart, and he does that by telling him a story. Now, the story he tells him is the famous story of the Good Samaritan, which I'm sure you've heard, in which there's a man that goes from Jerusalem to Jericho. This was a road that was known for its danger, and so Jesus is playing on that, and this man gets robbed as he's going. And now Jesus explains that that while this man's laying on the road, beaten, you know, half dead, a priest comes along. But instead of stopping and helping him, this priest goes to the other side of the road. And then along comes a Levite. And instead of stopping and helping him, he goes to the other side and passes by as well. But then along comes this Samaritan, the hated people, right? And instead of going to the other side of the road, which was, by the way, what the Jews did when they would walk from Jerusalem to, say, Galilee, and they had to go through the land of Samaritans, they would go around it, right? They would avoid the Samaritans. They wouldn't talk to them. They wouldn't eat with them. They definitely would not touch them. And here this man comes, a Samaritan comes, scoops this guy up, puts him on his own donkey, takes him to an inn, and looks after him until he is well. And this, I mean, I think for us, we, when we read this, we really don't understand. You know, it reminds me again, like, of Mr. Rogers, if you will, in that looking back, you know, it's hard for us to see just how countercultural this was. It's hard to experience the shock value of the story. And in particular, the shock value being, and I find that this is a helpful way to understand the story, is that Jesus turns the story on its head in that we are used to hearing a story in which the hero is humanized and the villain is dehumanized. Now, we do this because, right, we want to cheer for the hero and the glory that the hero is going to get, and we want to cheer for the demise that the villain's going to get. Jesus flips this on its head, and instead, he makes the heroes of the story, the priests and the Levites, right, he makes them the villains, and he makes the villain, the Samaritan, he makes him the hero of the story, completely changing the way that you see this, and you start to understand that Jesus is talking about your heart. In that the man asked, and I would say that the man asked the right question, you know, who's my neighbor? The problem is that he asked it with the wrong heart. He asked it with a heart of seeking to exclude. Instead of a heart that was open, it was a heart that was closed. And Jesus is getting that, no, I've asked you to come and to love people with a heart that is open to caring for people. And look, I'm going to use a Samaritan, the villain, I'm going to use him as the hero to show you that he could even see this man in need and was able to show mercy to him because his heart was in the right place.
I find that this unlikely character, the Samaritan, practiced justice as well. I mean, the story is flipped on its head, this unlikely character, and he practices justice. And you reference Leviticus 19. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to understand what Jesus meant by love your neighbor, there's a list of things there. And he really does just about all of them. Mm-hmm. That is referenced in that. Leviticus 19, 9 to 18.
On that note, notice this. This is a part of the story I think often is missed, but is absolutely crucial. Jesus not only used, you know, the commonly vilified person of that time, but he made this person the hero that even Jesus would have disagreed with. You have to understand, Jesus would have disagreed with the Samaritans' religious worldview. He was the embodiment of that disagreement. They believe that the Old Testament was done with Moses, and Jesus is this living example that no, God isn't finished, and that he has come to restore what God had started and what was broken. But yet Jesus uses this man, uses a Samaritan, right? That only held to the first five books of the Old Testament, that saw Moses as the last prophet. Somebody that would not have, you know, and we see this when Jesus interacts with the Samaritans. They're asking him theological questions. They disagree with one another, but yet Jesus is quite comfortable making him the hero of the story. And I think what's significant to me in this is that I think Jesus is continually showing and teaching that you can love people that you disagree with. And in fact, that you and I need to be able to do that. We need to be able to, on the one hand, deeply disagree with people, and on the other hand, deeply love and care for them because they have dignity. They are God's creation and made in his image. And I really like the way that Timothy Keller puts this, and I think this is something that more and more Christians got to wrestle with, because I think they often will sacrifice truth on the altar of love. And I think we got to be careful about that. But Keller says this. He says, all churches must understand love and identify with their local communities and social settings, and yet at the same time be able and willing to critique and challenge it. I think that's absolutely right.
And I think that was demonstrated really well when Jesus interacted with that woman at the well, right? Remember, he actually, like you said earlier, Andy, when Jews traveled, they tried to stay away from Samaria. But the interesting thing is, in this story, Jesus actually travels with his disciples right through Samaria. And it was around noontime. He's tired. And while the disciples are gone to get some food or whatever they were doing, they were on an errand, he actually asks this Samaritan woman for a drink of water. And in this interaction, the Samaritan woman is really surprised. For one, she's a woman. Secondly, she is a Samaritan, and the fact that she is out drawing water during the hottest part of the day, it was obvious what kind of woman she was, right? She's the kind of woman that is not very highly esteemed in her own community. This is the kind of person that Jesus is talking to, and he actually reveals that he is Messiah to her. And throughout all four Gospels, this is the first place where we see that Jesus actually reveals himself to be the Messiah. And he does so to a Samaritan woman of ill repute. And when the Samaritan woman realizes that Jesus is not just your ordinary Jewish dude, she asks him about the religious practices, you know, like, which mountain do we worship on, right? And Jesus actually corrects her. I'm like, yeah, salvation is from the Jews. You guys are actually wrong about this. And yet this is the woman to whom he actually reveals his identity, true identity, right? So here is a case where Jesus disagrees with this person and yet loves her in a way that nobody has loved her before.
Now, to bring this back to Mr. Rogers, and this is probably the more controversial aspect of the film, is that there were people that worked on the set and that he associated, or that were part of the show actually, that were openly gay. And so that brought all sorts of questions, and they in the film kind of gingerly deal with this issue. But I think it is significant, right? That not only was there somebody that was, by the way, that was gay on the set too, but also there were some pretty rough characters that were on the set, you know, that did things like taking Mr. Rogers' camera and taking pictures of their butts and doing all sorts of, yeah. You know, weird stuff. You know, those were the things that they told us. But I think it's interesting that, again, here he loved and he cared for those people. Now, that becomes a question. Did he disagree with them or not? Well, that never really got answered in the documentary. But I know that that's what we are called to do. We are called to love and care for those people that even that we disagree with. And I think one of the questions that we have got to ask ourselves that's incredibly convicting when you read a story like The Good Samaritan and realizing that human beings are made in God's image, they have dignity, we need to love and care for them, is that if you were to ask Jesus, who's my neighbor, who would Jesus make the hero of the story? You know, that's a convicting question. Who are those people that you would like to exclude from your love and care? That's the question that we need to ask, because we need to see what's going on in our own hearts as we seek to be a good neighbor.
We need to wrap this up, but I want to bring it back around to the last question that they asked in the movie. I don't know if you remember this. They asked all the people that were in the movie, who loved you into loving? I mean, it is pretty emotional time in the sense that they were reflecting on the people that made an impact in their life because they loved them to an immense degree. And I mean, you could see that in all the people that worked with him, that stuck with him for the 20, 30 odd years. I can't remember how long it was on. I mean, it was amazing to see their affection for him, even the gentleman that was gay. As well, right? I mean, he cried when he talked about Fred Rogers and the effect he had on his life in that time that he worked with him.
Well, maybe we should end our show with that question. Terry, who loved you into loving?
I mean, I would probably say my mom, for sure. She would be the most effective person to my life to show love to others. But, I mean, there was teachers as well that really took their time in my life as I was growing up to help me in different areas and show that concern and love in those times as I was growing up and learning.
Steve?
My friend from Columbia Bible College, Andrew Nolte, I remember when I was struggling with all kinds of lies that were told to me that I would amount to nothing, that I was worthless as a human being, he was the first one, and very deliberately, I remember him saying this very deliberately, that is a pure lie. And I remember hearing that for the first time and really being taken aback by it. And that was a real turning point. That's the point where I started to love myself, and from that place I was able to love other people as well. And I think, I really believe that the Holy Spirit worked through him at that time to turn my heart.
Yeah, I'd say for me, it would be my mother. But I think even more than that, was actually reading the Bible and getting to know the person of Jesus Christ. That had a huge and continues to have a significant impact on me and in my prayer life as well.
Well, thank you for joining us, listeners. The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more things to think about.